Okay, good evening, everybody. We're a week away from that wonderful celebration, which kind of gave me the impetus to do what I'm doing this evening, talk a bit about the issues of interaction with the non-Jewish world. I want to make it clear that a lot of the subject matter that I'm really focusing on is not so much giving you answers to these problems, because I think these are things you've got to work out. Meaning, like, how to interact with the non-Jewish world, how to express your individuality, thinking about God. You know, these are issues which we're all grown up, and we all need to work on this, and we all need to think about it. Not maybe every minute of the day, but from time to time, I think these are important things to think about. What I do like to stress in the Shiurim is the source material, because the source material is fascinating. What I think it makes you realize, more than anything else, is that a lot of the stuff that we are thinking about in the 21st century was being thought about in the first century. Plus ça change, there's nothing really that is new in terms of our Jewish experience to what's gone on. Oh, it's a different type of experience in terms of the locations and where we find ourselves, but the basic challenges are the same. And tonight is no exception, because the Jew and non-Jewish world is a very serious question, which, certainly when we all interact, whatever way we do, even if we are involved in, let's say, a Jewish school, or involved in a JCC or whatever, you know, in that kind of environment, but there is no question about it that somewhere along the line we have to interact with our non-Jewish neighbor. It could be the person that we... I just can't even think of that. There's so many examples. You know, you go to the mail office, the post office, wherever it may be. You interact with the non-Jewish world, and it's a challenge. The challenge is not so much on those kind of fleeting interactions, but I think the challenge is on the more constant interactions. And you'll see over here, I started this whole piece here by talking about the ideal existence. Now, maybe this is not everybody's ideal existence, but some people might consider it the ideal existence to live in Israel. You're with Jews all the time, and therefore, you're not interacting essentially with the non-Jewish world in a constant way like we do here. But the reality is, for the majority of Jews in the world today, it's getting less and less, I've got to say. The majority in another 20 years, I think the estimate is that the majority of Jews will be in Israel. Okay, we're talking now about 7 million Jews in Israel, and the balance is sort of almost at the tipping point, which is kind of interesting in itself. But the reality for the majority of Jews today is that we're not in a place where we are totally with Jews and interacting with Jews the whole time. Okay, which does have its own interesting dynamics, which again, not for now. How do we interact with the non-Jewish world? That's the question. How are we supposed to interact with the non-Jewish world? And this is the dilemma. And the dilemma is a very simple dilemma, and we all know it. The dilemma is that if we keep too much distance, then we feel it brings on anti-Semitism. Okay, if we stay too far away. Why is the caricature that we find in the classic anti-Semitic material, the caricature of the Jew looking what we would call the particularly the Hasidic Jew, you know, this is the one that is caricatured so much in that type of material, and it's because for the anti-Semite on that level, the Nazi, whoever they may be, this was the sign of distance. This was the incentive, I guess, that stirred up the fires of hatred, if that's one way to look at it. Too distant, too far away, and then we get into issues of anti-Semitism. Of course, what's happening at the moment is very disturbing in America, where a lot of the community feels, you know, we are interacting in a very positive way, but we'll come back to that. If we get too close, we go to the other extreme, which is what so many people in the 19th century thought after the Enlightenment and the whole history there. We end up with assimilation. We ended up with assimilation rate. Today in America, it's come out, the Pew Report, when was it, two or three years ago, talking about 70% of American Jews will not marry Jewish. And that's a level which is beyond contemplation. As I put it to somebody, I said, Kirov on a one-to-one basis is seemingly very successful, but as a movement, as an attempt to bring Jews back to Judaism, to some sort of Jewish identity, let alone not talking about Jewish practice, as a movement, Kirov and everything around it seems to have been essentially a big failure. And the person I was speaking with who was in that particular type of activity and for much of his time didn't disagree with me, okay, on a sort of macro basis. So the question is getting the balance. How do we get the balance between keeping distance and at the same time having to be close, having to work closely with non-Jews? We work closely maybe in our jobs, maybe in terms of as where we live or whatever it may be. Okay, how to get that balance right so that there's not, on the one hand, anti-Semitism. We don't generate anti-Semitism. It may still be there, but not that we've caused it. And on the other hand, not hopefully we're not going to be in a situation where we get so friendly and so connected that assimilation doesn't become a problem, meaning people do assimilate, don't even think about it, which unfortunately today, as we know, is a very, very serious issue. As much as the Orthodox world has its problems, I really believe the most challenged community in America today, almost without question, is the conservative community in the United States, being caught in the middle between a very left-wing kind of element which wants to sort of dilute the style and everything else to bring it towards reform. Reform I don't even want to talk about because reform, again, has so many issues which they're sort of waking up to, but it may very well be way too late for the movement in general. I don't know. That's a whole discussion for another time. But I think conservative Judaism has a real challenge on this front because it's clear that without some sort of Jewish content in people's lives, then the assimilation rates really are almost unavoidable. And that's going to be something which, again, we may come back to towards the end. What I want to show you, this dilemma, how to look at the non-Jewish world, how to deal with the non-Jewish world, is something where there is a fascinating Gemara. I always feel that for one of the sources particularly was worth coming out. Okay, I would like to hope for all of them. But for this one, this is a wow. And it's the first source on the first page, Shabbat Lamed Gimel. Rabbis had an argument, three rabbis essentially, about the Romans. Are the Romans good for us, or are they bad for us? Unbelievable. And listen to this Gemara, because this is... I've got little notes on the side here, sort of, as we go along. You'll see what I'm getting at. GWB, what comes out in a minute. Patach Rabbi Yehuda V'Omar. Now, I'm not sure which Rabbi Yehuda this is, but I've got a feeling it's Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. Judah the Prince. Judah the Prince began the conversation about the Romans. And what did he say? Kama na'im ma'asem shal umazo. How pleasant are the ways of this nation, of Rome, right? And he goes in for a whole discussion here. Tiknu shvakim. They make markets, right? Without the stock exchange, where would we be? You know, all the investors. Tiknu gesharim. They make bridges, right? That's why I wrote about the GWB. Tiknu merchatzaot. And they make bathhouses, which in the first century, the common era, was quite an innovation. That was Rabbi Yehuda's praise of Roman culture, Roman civilization. Rabbi Yossi shatak. Rabbi Yossi kept quiet. He didn't say a word. Okay, so obviously he didn't want to commit himself. Nana Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. Now comes Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. Shimon ben Yochai, you all know, is the famous rabbi. We celebrate his birth and his death on Lag BaOmer. He was a kitzoni shebekitzonim. Today, I guess he would have been probably a member of the Satmar community, maybe even more to the right than that. And he says, I'm sorry, rabbis, you've all got it wrong. V'omar, kol ma shetiknu lo tikta ela l'tzarech atzman. You think the Romans did it for us? They did it for themselves. And he has no illusions about their lifestyle. Tiknu shvakim lo shibem zonot. Why do they have marketplaces? They can put prostitutes there. In other words, they can be as corrupt as they want to be. Mechatzaot ladein behem atzmam. Right? And they have bathhouses so they can pleasure themselves. And I guess talk about homosexuality or whatever. Gesharim. Why do they have bridges? This is the remind me of the Washington Bridge. Litomea meches, to take tolls. Right? That's what he said. Nothing has changed. 2,000 years. So that's Shimon Bar Yochai. He says, feh. In other words, as one would hear, you know, you can hear Tevye saying this. Feh. You know, you're telling me the Romans are good for us? Feh. Absolutely not. Holach Yehuda ben Gerim. Interesting, there was a gentleman called Yehuda ben Gerim, so I presume he was a son of converts. And Siper Divrayim, and he told over this conversation, presumably to his Roman friend. And this is not a good story. V'nishmu l'malchut, and the word got back to the Roman leadership. And what did they do? Omru. Yehuda she'ila yitale. Yehuda, the first Rabbi Yehuda, he gave us a praise. He should be elevated. And that's why I think it's Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. He eventually became friends with Mark Antony. Mark Antoninus, there's a whole story about him. And clearly he had a very positive relationship with the Roman world. Yossi sheshatag yigle. That Yossi, the Rabbi Yossi, kept quiet. He goes into exile. That was their punishment for him. And Letzipori to Tzipori, which was one of the towns in the north of Israel. Shimon shegina yorei. And Shimon ben Yochai, who basically said what he thought of us, he is wanted, dead or alive, probably dead. And of course, at that point, Shimon ben Yochai runs away and he goes and lives in a cave with his son, and you know, for 13 years, and they lived on a caribs and whatever else they could find. Amazing stories about Shimon ben Yochai, unbelievable.
Is he the one that they smuggle out of the...
No, that's Yochai ben Zakkai, that's someone else. Shimon ben Yochai is after, this is about 150 years after the destruction of the temple. Right, and essentially what has happened is, this is even after, I think you can say it's after the Hadrian persecutions around the Bar Kokhba revolt. I think this is happening even after that. All right, and we're getting here an interesting situation.
It's 200.
Yeah, he's around 200. So if it is, that's why I'm not sure if it's Yehuda Nasi, but if it is, it makes sense because he was very pro-Roman, he really was. So what you see from these three rabbis essentially is a discussion about our connection as Jews to the prevailing society around us. And you can see already in those days there was tremendous extremes going from Yehuda on one side to Shimon ben Yochai on the other side. Unbelievable. Right? And it's so interesting because essentially this is what we're saying. We're saying that even amongst our views there are people today. And there's no question about it. I mean, I'm not talking about Mea Shearim and other places that one can think of, not too far from where we're sitting here. But there are clearly Jews in the world today who say the only way we can deal with a non-Jewish world is by building a virtual reality wall around ourselves. Call it the ghetto, call it whatever you want to call it. And this is what's been done. Other Jews, maybe, I would say, in other communities, have looked for more integration. Yeah, we can keep up Jewish standards, but let's integrate in terms of being involved, let's say, in politics, being involved in communal activities, situations, whatever it may be. There are different ways of trying to integrate, trying to become part of the wider community. And, interesting how so many different communities sort of try and deal with this, and we'll come back to this at the end because I want to show you more sources. The question of remaining to be different, right? This is at the bottom of the first page, and this is about Brit Milah. Okay, why do Jews have the mitzvah of Brit Milah? The first quote is from the Torah. We'll do the second quote. Sefer Chinuch, famous Rabbi Aaron of Barcelona, 12th century, and this is a book that apparently he wrote for his son. It's the most phenomenal sefer you'd ever read. He went through all the 630 commandments and he tried to give reasons for each one. So here, mitzvah bet, he's trying to explain why do we have a mitzvah brit milah. Says Rabbi Aaron, Mishrashea mitzvah, is the second quote. You see where it says brit milah, the second Hebrew paragraph. Mishrashea mitzvah, zo lefi sharatza Hashem yitbarach likvo ba'am. That in order to be separate, there had to be some sort of permanent sign on the body. So Brit Milah is a sign of separation. Simple, according to the Chinuch. But Tzurat Gufam, in the form of their body. As we are different in our souls, we have a different neshama, so too do we have in terms of our physical presentation, we have a different goof, a different body. That's his idea. So clearly, separation is, according to the Sefer Chinuch, in the essence of the mitzvah of Brit. And here you see the Rambam, and we can sort of develop this a little bit further on the subject, which I don't want to go into in great detail, but it probably deserves a shiur by itself, which is the question of Chukat HaGoy. Chukat HaGoy is one of those things that people band around this expression. I was asked a question a few weeks ago The question was interesting, that now there's a very, and again, I'm not going to comment on what people have done, what people do, but I was asked the question, does, a young couple are getting married, does the, is it prevailing custom to put to, or could it be acceptable, let's put it that way, for the chatan and kala to give each other rings? Okay, to give each other. Obviously the chatan has to give the kala ring, but should the kala give the chatan a ring? And I explained that, obviously under the chuppah, no, that does kind of create a certain halachic situation which you don't really want to create. After the chuppah, then it depends on certain circumstances. The yeshiva that I went to, when we discussed it, this is like 42 years ago, the word came back almost without discussion, mustn't do it, chukas agoy. It's what the non-Jews do, and therefore because they do it, we don't do it. Okay, that was the answer that I was given. And, you know, thinking about it, I suppose it's an easy way of solving the problem, of dealing with the problem. But you know what? Sometimes there are different circumstances in which you find yourself, different communities, and I think very much the posek, the person who would have to decide this particular question, would look at the person, what type of community you're coming from. Is it where they do this or where they don't do this? And I'll give you sort of, that's one example of many, many examples today of chukat agoy. But look at this comment from the Rambam, and it's very, very interesting. I look at his examples, and I go on the subway every day, and believe me, this hasn't changed again in about 1,000 years. Listen to this. Bottom paragraph. Ein holchim b'chukat ovdei kochavim, v'lo medamim lahem. You should not look like the non-Jews. Lo b'malbush, not the way they dress. V'lo b'sar, not the way they have their hair cut. Okay, there are such crazy haircuts running around everywhere today. It's just beyond belief. Ukiyotze behem and similar things, shne'emar, because the Rambam says, it says in the Torah, v'lo telchu b'chukot ha-goyim, shouldn't go in the ways of the non-Jews, v'ne'emar b'chukotem lo telechu. Again, a repetition. The question is why the verse is repeated. That, I think, is explained elsewhere. V'ne'emar shom elecha pentinokesh achareim hakol b'inyan echad. Who, Masih, is warning us in all these verses are coming to the same conclusion. Shelo yadam alehem, you should not be like them. Ela yiyeh Yisrael muvdal mehem. We have to be separate from them. So here we see the very clear guideline here of separation. All right, we said at the beginning, too much separation or too little. So how do we deal with this? Here, as far as Rambam is concerned, separation is the order of the day. Right, and certainly in the way we dress and the way that we cut our hair. V'yodov malbusho, and you should be known by your clothing, ubishar masav, and your other actions. Kamoshu muvdal mehem madao b'deotov, that you're different also in your knowledge, in your ideas, in your hashkafot, which is true. There's no question about it. As somebody put it to me recently, it's so even the difference between an Orthodox Jew and a non-Orthodox Jew. But you go to between a Jew, let's say an Orthodox Jew and a non-Jew, is so fundamental. Just this idea of the day beginning at nighttime. All right, we take this as kind of an automatic that when we're talking about a chag, we know instinctively that we're talking about the night before. We're talking about, you know, beginning on a Wednesday evening for Thursday and Friday or whatever. And this concept of time, of the idea that it has a different format, etc., is very, very different to the way the world looks, the way the world thinks. And sometimes you come across it. When you say that the holiday is going to be Thursday and Friday, right? I always have to explain, even after so many years of working with the same people, Thursday and Friday means Wednesday evening. All right, it does actually start from five. The chef I work with in Colombian gets it by now, but it's taken him 10 years to really get it. It took a long time. It's just a different mindset. It's a different way of just looking at the world and celebrating our holidays. Just that little point alone, let alone all the other things that we differ. And he goes on. God said, "I will separate you from the nation." Lo yulbash malbush miuchad lahem. Don't wear something which they specifically wear. Now this became very, very interesting around the 1500s, and it was the question of the doctors wearing white coats. Right? That was something that became, if you'd actually turn to the second page, and you'll see I've actually got this here. Very, very fascinating. The question of the doctors having some sort of sign that they're a doctor, and it was, again, historically, I don't know the exact date when it started, but there's clearly references over here to practices, non-Jewish practices, which the rabbis of the day thought were actually acceptable. And one of them was wearing a white coat. A doctor should be recognizable, you know, should be, you should know exactly who it is if you're in a hospital setting or whatever it may be. And therefore, wearing the, nowadays the scrubs or whatever they may be, even though the idea has come from the non-Jewish world, it's something that the Jewish world should adopt. And this was the discussion 500 years ago. And believe it or not, there were still rabbis who said no. Because they do it, we shouldn't be doing it. We've got to keep that separation. We've got to be different. Unbelievable. And again, you'll just see over here how far it goes. Is the first paragraph here is a Tosfot, the commentary of the grandchildren, mainly grandchildren of Rashi. And this is Tosfot Avodah Zarah. And he says over there the following statement. It's this first paragraph of the second page. He's talking about a certain practice which Jews did, even though it was non-Jewish practice. Interesting what the Gemara talks about. Gemara says that the non-Jews, when the king used to die, they used to burn not only the body of the non-Jewish king, they burned all his furniture. They burnt all his clothing. Everything was burnt together with the body, according to their particular practice in those days. And there is a reference in Tanakh to a Jewish king, the same thing being done. Fascinating. And the rabbis are very perturbed by this because it's surely b'chukotem lo telecho. It's surely practicing something that the non-Jews practice. Why did we do this? And you'll see what it says here. Tosfot says, v'afakal, end of the first line, the chetiva b'raita, even though it says in the Torah, right, that you shouldn't, in other words, that seemingly certain things were done, yesh le'eso, you still have to forbid it, kivan shalahem hu chok la'avodat kochavim. Because the idea is that what they're doing has some sort of idolatrous connection. For instance, dumya de matseva kishahoyu makrivim alea avot haita huva. We know that the Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov made their own altars to bring sacrifice. And that was something which was very beloved. And we know that they weren't criticized for that. But once the non-Jews started doing it, they did it for their gods, then it became hated. It became something we don't do anymore. So Tosfot says that even if it's something which is not going to be for the purposes of idolatrous worship, if it comes from the non-Jewish world, he says it by definition, it is something which is hevel. It is, I don't know how you translate hevel, it's something which is not to be taken seriously. Shtut is something which is ridiculous or whatever. Don't do it. As far as Tosfot is concerned, anything that comes out of the non-Jewish world in terms of these types of general practices should not be done. Says the Ran from the Spanish school. Interesting how it divides between Germany, which is Tosfot, Germany and France, and the Ran, Rabbeinu Nissim, who's more inclined towards the Spanish school. The Spanish school was very much more an open-minded group of people. There's certainly people like the Ramban, Nachmanides, obviously Rambam as well, Maimonides. They came from a world where seemingly their interactions with the non-Jewish world were much more positive. You learn the Abar Banel, you'll see what he does. He basically is quoting non-Jews all the time. He, in his commentary, as much as he says, there is opinion number one, opinion number two, Rashi and whatever, he then says, v'chochmeya notzrim, and he quotes the non-Jewish opinion, which is very, very interesting. It's what the Sansino Chumash did very, very successfully, I would argue. And I told Sid this a few weeks ago, I'm upset that these books are now been put into Seamus. We mustn't use them anymore. We've all made ourselves, unfortunately, a bit less educated by going to a Chumash, which is very nice, very beautifully produced, but doesn't give us that range of views which the Sansino does, particularly in the essays. Rabbi Hertz, what he writes at the end there, they may be a bit outdated, but they are so rare. He writes about evolution, he writes about biblical criticism, but from an Orthodox point of view, fascinating. So that Chumash is really not to be thrown away, not to be put into the the box to be buried. Definitely not. I know it's not popular opinion, but you ask scholars about it, you'll see they're...
Everything has been art-scrolled.
Art-scrolled is now a verb, to art-scroll something, correct. And again, I'm not sure what to say about that, except that clearly, as far as they're concerned, everything that they would probably take the more extreme point of view. I do understand that. I'm happy with what Rabbeinu Nissim says, because he takes what I call the logical point of view. And his point of view is, he says, listen, if it comes from the non-Jewish world, and it makes sense, like wearing a white coat if you're a doctor, then do it. What is idolatrous about putting on a white coat if you are practicing medicine? What is wrong with that? And this is what he says. Look at the second paragraph in Hebrew. Lefi shelo asra Torah, elu chukot shelo dekochavim, elu devarim shel hevel betala. He says, what the Torah forbids are these ridiculous things that the non-Jews did as part of their worshipping. V'kulan yesh b'em tzarech avodat kochavim, and it's part of their idolatry. Avod devarim shel ta'am shorun. Things which make sense, things of reason, were allowed. And this is where, you know, you get into an interesting discussion here about the views towards non-Jewish practices, whether we should adopt them, whether we should be part of it or not. I mean, in tongue-in-cheek, I wrote here cell phones, because I'm not sure whether that's something which is Devarim Shel Tam. I don't know if it's actually got any sort of logical basis to it whatsoever. All I can say is sitting on the subway watching people holding machines, $500 a piece, playing games, Pac-Man or whatever it's called these days, on a machine which they pay $500 for, blows my mind. All right, you know, and there they are. I'm always determined. Troubles you get arrested doing this, start taking pictures on the subway. But I once saw a whole row, must have been seven or eight people sitting on one of those long seats, all of them just doing these games.
Unless they have Wi-Fi.
In the subway, you can't get anything. You know, they may eventually come out with it. That's even more scary. Then they'll start having these loud conversations. Oiva voilona. And look at the bottom here. Look what Ramosha Feinstein says. Because again, the voice of reason. Because Ramosha understood this. He understood that certain things which are from the non-Jewish world, but are matters which clearly have some sort of logic, have some sort of reason, they are to be, you know, followed, or certainly to be considered. And he's talking about general clothing, right? We know that why the German Jews called Yekkers, because Yakka means a short jacket, because they compromised on Jewish clothing. Always the Jews wore long clothes. Long came the German Jews, and they start wearing short clothes, short jacket, Yekkers, Yakka. And that's why they got this title, which for the Eastern European Jew was a term of, how should we say, the Hasidim used to look down. Sorry?
It was a derogatory.
It was very derogatory, to put it mildly. Nowadays, we talk about Yekkers and we kind of smile, because particularly if people are descended from that particular part of the world. But that was the original idea. So, compromise on clothing. So, somebody asked Ramosha Feinstein, is this really a compromise? Look what he says. The imkein poshut, says Ramosha. He says, obvious, last paragraph here. She'ein shum shemetz isur. There's no trace. He's making it very clear, because he realizes some people want him to be very strict about it. He says there's no trace of prohibition b'stam begadim shelovshim b'medina zo, to the clothing that we wear in this country, talking in America. Av shegam anochrim loshim begadim elu. Right, we're sort of so up with the fashions, you know, we're wearing it what everybody else is wearing. Midin malbushi nochrim, and even though you might say this is part of their clothing style, it doesn't matter, he says. De'emem chashash shemetzakum, there's no idolatry in this whole clothing style. V'nechush, or some sort of practice, again, some sort of idolatrous practice. V'gam lo davar tamua ela lanoi uchadome. Right, you just want to look decent, you want to look presentable, you want to look nice. Therefore, we dress accordingly. So for me to come along, says Rabbi Feinstein, I don't know when this was written, probably in the 60s, to come along and start saying that every Jew has got to walk around back in the long coats and everything else, the answer is no. This is not. I mean, he did. That was his style. He was such a balsecha. I'm just sorry I never met him. I have to tell this story because it's such an unbelievable story. He used to go to Hunter, which is up in the mountains during the summer. Which is, again, a lot of the Yeki people from Washington Heights used to go there. And there was a infirmary there. And the infirmary, the people ran it, husband and wife, were Holocaust survivors. And one year they had their nephew staying with them, who was becoming more religious. He went to yeshiva, maybe in Brooklyn, wherever, and he was staying with his uncle and aunt in the bungalow colony, whatever it was, the holiday place. And the aunt said to him, tomorrow Rabbi Feinstein, Moses Feinstein is coming to visit. And the young man went berserk. He said, did you say Moses Feinstein? He said, the Rabbi Moshe Feinstein? She said, yeah, he's a wonderful man. He's coming up to the bungalow colony, and he usually comes into the infirmary on the first day. We check him out, make sure he's okay. You know, he's not a young man, and we want to make sure he's fine. So the young man, maybe 15 or 16, he said, can I meet him? So he says, sure, come along tomorrow. He'll be here but probably around midday. Come in. So, of course, what happened the next day? The young man comes in to meet Ramosha. He's put on his hat and his suit and everything else. And Ramosha walks in, doesn't notice the young man, but he notices the uncle and aunt. And the aunt goes over to him, gives him a big hug. She says, Rabbi Feinstein, how are you? And a little kiss on the cheek. And Ramosha was just, you know, he took this as part of the way that he would greet this woman every single year. The nephew in the corner wanted to do a korach. He wanted to disappear into the ground. He was horrified. And he went over to Ramosha after. He said, Rabbi Feinstein, I must apologize for my aunt. Apologize for her behavior. You know, she doesn't. And he went, Ramosha went, shh, don't say a word. And he looked at Ramosha and he said, look at the numbers on their arms. They're Holocaust survivors, both of them. Zognish, don't say a word. Right? When it comes to this relationship that we have, this is the way it is. And this was a man who used what I call the fifth chelik of Shulchan Aruch. He understood. Common sense has to prevail. It's an amazing story.
My grandfather.
And yeah, there's a lot of people who still remember him very, very well. And that's the halachic approach, which, I mean, you know, it's a one-off. It's not a, he didn't go around hugging everybody, you know, it wasn't Shlomo Kalbach or anything like that. But the reality was, it doesn't matter. He did his thing, and Shlomo did his thing. Shlomo also got wonderful stories, but I don't want to go through those now. Go to the next page, because there is a contrast there. What we've generally get the feeling in terms of the laws of Chukat HaGoy is that we've got to have a certain distancing, and we've got to analyze what's coming from the non-Jewish world, and we've got to say to ourselves, does it make sense? Yeah, okay, I can use it. But once it becomes more religious in nature, then I have to kind of be circumspect. That's according to what I'm considering to be the mainstream opinion. Although Tosfot says anything coming out of the non-Jewish world, if it's something that we have to adopt as a practice, we shouldn't do it. All right, that's that one side of the discussion. I've got over here, what about creating positive ties with the non-Jewish world? And the halakha says it, the Mishnah in Shviyit, it's about a third of the way down. The Mishnah says, "Machziki midei nochrim b'shviyit." In the seventh year, when everybody is, the economy has stopped for 1 year, the farmers are not working, and there are non-Jews in Eretz Yisrael, you've got to support them. Avolo yidei Yisrael v'sholim b'shlomom. Right, in other words, the Jewish people, the laws of Hefka, they can come in. Hi, good evening. And they can take from the produce, but for the non-Jews who maybe don't want to do that, you've got to go and help them. V'sho'alim b'shloma, and you also ask after their welfare, mibnei darkei shalom. There is this principle which is known as darkei shalom, doing things for the ways of peace. What is called, I guess, I've translated it, positive social interaction. There is this Gemara in Gittin, which is very well known. In other words, there's laws of the field. You leave a corner, you leave the droppings of the people gathering the crops, and the non-Jew comes, the poor person comes and picks it up. What happens if there's a non-Jew doing that? The answer is you don't stop him. Mibnei darkei shalom, because you want to keep the peace. Tana rabbanan, mefarnes emani enochrim emani Yisrael. If you have poor people in your city, then you have an obligation to support them, whether they're Jewish or not Jewish. I don't think he's saying you prioritize by supporting the non-Jews more than the Jews, but, you know, if you're writing $100 to your Jewish charity, you know, you can still give $5, $10 to the non-Jewish charity. You know, you sort of kind of prioritize it whichever way you want to do it. But mevakrim chole nochrim chole Yisrael, you have to visit the sick ones of the non-Jews together with the sick ones of the Jews. Another story, and I got to embellish this with stories, I can't help it. My Rosh Hashiva in England, Leib Lopion, son of Reb Eli Lopion, Nebuch was very sick. Toward the end of his life, he really was very sick. He smoked like a chimney from the earliest days, and had lung cancer, and he eventually died of it. I think he was 63 when he died. And I went back to the yeshiva in 1974 after I'd left, went back for Shavuot. I left the beginning of the year before Sukkot, went to study, and came back with a friend for for Shavuot in the following year, and went to see the Rosh Yeshiva. And in fact, at that time, he was already not well, and he'd been in the hospital for a number of weeks, and he was coming home for Yontif. So we knocked on the door, we saw the Rebbetzin. The Rebbetzin said, "Ah, you got a car, can you go and pick up the Rosh Yeshiva? He's in the hospital in Newcastle, which is next door to where I was studying in Geisen." And we gladly said, "Well, of course we're going to pick him up." So we went. Never forget this. He was sitting on the bed, waiting to go, and very, you know, mechubad, as he would be, with his hat, the whole thing. And as we got there, he asked us for 2 minutes. He said, "Just give me two more minutes." He said, "Rosh Yeshiva, you can have 2 hours. We don't care. Yontif's not till 10 o'clock at night. You know, in England, everything's very late there." And then he did something which I'll never forget. He went round to every bed. This was 20 beds in one of these old Victorian hospitals. And every person he said goodbye to. Not one Jew in the whole place. All minors. Now, if you know what a British minor is like, you won't want to have anything to do with them. This is like the car workers in Detroit, if that's the way to describe them. Probably I'm not quite sure what to compare them to. But we said to Rosh Yeshiva, do you know these people? And he said, "No, but they know that I'm a rabbi. And as a rabbi, they know that I'm here. I may be sick, but I've also got to give them encouragement. I've got to give them strength. Because that's my job. That's what a man of religion is expected to do." And therefore, before he left the room, he spoke to every single person. It was unforgettable. And that, again, is what we're saying over here. This is exactly what it says, according to the Gemara, "Mevakrim chole nachrim chole Yisrael." If you're with non-Jewish people who are sick, you've got to be with them. You've got to visit them. You've got to strengthen them. And "Vekovrim metei nachrim metei Yisrael." If necessary, and you have to be involved in the burial, you've got to be involved in the burial. "Mibnei darkei shalom," because of the ways of peace. As we say over here, further down, making a Kiddush Hashem. Making a Kiddush Hashem. I wrote on the back here this famous story, the $98,000. I don't know if you remember it. A Lubavitch rabbi bought a desk. It must have been about 10 years ago. And glued to the bottom of the desk was a bag, taped to the bottom, and in it was $98,000 in cash. The woman sold him a desk with that amount of money at the bottom. Now again, what do you do? And his obvious reaction, he said, "No question about it, I return the money." Two things came out of that. Number one, he was on every TV station in the tri-state region, because people couldn't believe how honest this young man was. He must have been 23, 24. I think it was Chabad rabbi in Connecticut or somewhere like that. The other thing which was a bit upsetting was the reward. I think she gave him $100. I mean, that was really disturbing. You know, already. But what was she doing putting that money underneath the desk, sticking it to... But the Kiddush Hashem was phenomenal. It was one of those moments where you say to yourself, you know, Shreinu Matocha Keni, you say, what wonderful example that is, that such a young person, and wasn't even a temptation. You know, he said, "I didn't think about keeping the money." How many people around him sort of thought, you know, "You idiot," but they didn't want to say it. But on the contrary, when he explained, you know, religiously, "This is not mine, and God, you know, I believe that God has promised," you know, all the things that all the hashkafot that we have as Jews, he said it all on the interview with whatever TV station. I remember seeing it. It was phenomenal Kiddush Hashem. Absolutely phenomenal. And this is a Gemara, the bottom here, Yerushalmi, which talks also about they found certain at Sroa Didinra, they found also money in a certain sale, and the rabbi said, "Send it back, because this is not what I bought. I bought an object which wasn't necessarily very expensive, but I ended up finding money in it," and he didn't want to take the money. And again, the idea of Kiddush Hashem. The idea of Kiddush Hashem is not, this is extreme examples, returning money, but just to say a good morning. Just to say hello. Just to be connected in whatever way. And I wrote at the bottom here, the Blush of a Rav. Blush of a Rav was a Rav who lived in Brooklyn until he was over 100 years old. Israel Spira. If you have Yaffa Eliash, she just passed away in Nebuchadnezzar this year, her book of the Hasidic Tales of the Holocaust, it's one of those books you've just got to read. And she tells this story of the Blush of a Rav, that he was in a lineup in the concentration camp, and this was it. He knew that he never survived this lineup. He was very sick. He just wasn't, you know, he just was not going to survive. And he gets nearer and nearer, and that he can see that most people are being sent off to the gas chamber, and he knows that this is it. And he's preparing himself, he's saying his vidui, whatever. And he gets to the end of the line, and he sees there a gentleman sitting there, the Nazi. And without hesitation, he as his name is called out, Spira, it doesn't even say rabbi, he goes up to the Nazi and he says, "Guten Tag, Herr Muller." Herr Muller was his mailman, his postman. And he knew him. And Herr Muller looks at him, he says, "Herr Rabbiner, Not what are you doing here? And that wasn't the question to ask him. But he says, hey, Rabbeinu, get out of the line. He pulled him out of the line immediately. And the Blozer Rav wrote about this, and he said, one good morning every day. I didn't know who Herr Muller was. He was just my mailman. But I said good morning, and it saved my life. And he lived to be over 100. He literally came out of the camps. He came to Brooklyn. He, you know, unbelievable stories about this man. So this again is this idea, the positive interaction with the non-Jewish world. Just a good morning, just a kind word, whatever it may be. One doesn't know in what context, you know, what effect it can have. I want to just finish here this presentation, because what you can see is on the one hand, the separationist point of view. And on the other hand, we see certainly encouragement to get a bit closer, certainly to deal with the non-Jewish world in a respectful way. And this is interesting what Rav Soloveitchik wrote. Soloveitchik wrote about this, and his question was very simply, we have a tradition, the Aseret HaDibrot, Ten Commandments, it was a worldwide event. Nowadays it'll be on every, you know, TV channel you can think of. And his question basically is, why did it have to be publicized in such a big way? This was a revelation for the whole world. Why? And he basically writes about this, and he says that he believes that the world needed to hear the morality of the Bible. I mean, there's a lot of people who write about this, and this is again something we've touched on a bit, maybe a bit before. But what he does say is that before the Torah was given, there were two paradigms of non-Jews who became for us the type of non-Jew maybe that we have to deal with in our everyday lives. He said there was the Yitro, the father-in-law of Moshe. And there's the Amalek, who is the sworn enemy of the Jewish people. Sworn enemy of God, essentially. Not necessarily the Jewish people, but of God, as represented by the Jewish people. And what Rabbi Soloveitchik writes, which is so interesting, he says that the challenge in the world that we live in today is clearly a challenge of working out who is the Yitro. Because to say that every non-Jew, my grandmother would always say, every non-Jew is an anti-Semit. You know, came from Russia, had that kind of view of the world. And, you know, it wasn't something that you would argue with that generation about, because they suffered under the hands of non-Jews, and she wasn't even a Holocaust survivor, but she survived pogroms and told me a bit about her childhood, which she remembered. There was no discussion there. But for the person who does mix in the non-Jewish world, the sort of non-Jew that you come across could be a Yitro. And I find that's very true in so many cases. They want to know. What's the whole thing with Yitro? He wanted to find out. What is this? What is this about? What does it mean to be a monotheist? What is the religious approach to Judaism? What are you teaching the world that we don't know already? There could be non-Jews that you will come across. There'll be Amaleks. And those guys sort of, sometimes you find out who they are immediately. Sometimes you find out, unfortunately, much later. You find out sort of in a negative way. You thought they were a friend and they turn out to be not so much a friend. And Soloveitchik says the challenge essentially is in the world today to sort of understand that, you know, you're not going to be not everybody's going to be a Yitro, not everybody's going to be a Amalek, but in your interaction with the non-Jewish world to try and sort of identify the people you're dealing with. It's an interesting way of looking at it. What I think I've written here, which to me is the real challenge, the right-wing world, I think, sort of has made its point. The point has been made that we've got to live in a separate world. We create our own universe. It could be in the middle of New York City, doesn't matter. And the reality of it is that, you know, we have very little interaction, if any, or we do have to have interaction, but, you know, so to a minimum, with the non-Jewish world. If it's Goyish, it's not for us. There's a big problem with that. And the problem has been that so much of that influence, which they try to keep out of their community, unfortunately has come in. There's a drug problem in Brooklyn. Where it came from, I don't know, and there's a lot, unfortunately, has been written about it. It's very hard to keep out these influences, no matter where you are. I would guess Meir Shearim probably, you know, is about as tight as it gets, but even there, who knows? I really don't know. I would say for the real challenge is probably for the more modern Orthodox Jew, let's say, who wants to be part of the Jewish world and part of the secular world, and creating that kind of shiluv, you say in Hebrew, that kind of connection, that kind of mix, and getting it right. And that is very challenging, and it is, you know, something which we do, something maybe we do automatically, the way that we conduct ourselves in our lives, in our interactions, as was said before, how to interact with the non-Jewish world. The interesting observation here is the blessing we give to every Jewish child, a parent gives to a Jewish child on a Friday night. All right, Sarah Rivka Rachav Leah is quite obvious, but why Ephraim and Menashe? All right, why don't we say Yisimcha Leim Ke Avrami Saviyakov? We're doing the Imahot, why don't we do the Avot? And the argument is made, and I'm not sure if this comes from Soloveitchik, it may very well be his observation, that what was the greatness of Ephraim and Menashe as they were brought up in Egypt? Right, and Yosef had brought them up as Jews in a tremendously hostile environment. The values of Egypt were not the values of the house of Jacob where Yosef came from. And therefore it's saying to us that even if we find ourselves in an environment which is so much against the world that we want the world to be, nevertheless we should pray and hope that, you know, that as our kids should learn to be that level, have that level of independence, of strength, not only to be able to cope with the world, but to go out there and make a Kiddush Hashem. And that's why we choose Ephraim and Menashe, because they are the paradigm of young people who grew up in a non-Jewish world, in a really anti-society as far as we're concerned, and came out, nevertheless, part of the tribes of Israel. It's phenomenal. I've written at the bottom here some of the challenges and some of the interesting developments in the last couple of years. The ghetto policy of keeping everything separate, Square Town and all the other places that they have, I mentioned this before, this organization Footsteps, which is really disturbing to me, because it's an organization been set up in New York for Hasidic men and women who've broken away from their community. Clearly the experiment, and this is not tens or twenties or even hundreds, this is already thousands. I think their membership is running at about 10,000 people. And this is very frightening for the Hasidic community. It's an issue which I'm not even sure if the Rebbes are even remotely dealing with. But it's certainly something which this organization is dealing with, because they claim that in order for their members to be able to integrate into the non-Jewish world, which is what they're trying to achieve, they are giving them, number one, education, because a lot of the guys are coming out of school with no education whatsoever. And they're also giving them the social skills to be able to eventually, you know, after you do your degrees, to become a lawyer, to become an accountant, become whatever you want to be. And what is so disturbing from the Jewish point of view is that there's no essence of Judaism there. When they give up Hasidic Judaism, they are go to zero. They are literally, they'll get together on a Friday night, but there won't be any, what we would say, there won't be any davening, there won't be any even, you know, you'd think you'd go down a stage, become modern Orthodox. No, that would be the worst thing for them. Right? Even worse to become modern Orthodox than to become Reform, as far as I understand from the mentality where they're coming from. That's a really serious challenge. Because those are people coming out of the model number one, trying to keep the non-Jewish world away, and breaking out and going into the non-Jewish world and having no ability to find some sort of balance. It's really disturbing. On the other hand, there's a guy I have breakfast with more or less on a weekly basis called Lippe Schmelzer. Got to talk about this guy. He's a pop singer, Hasidic pop singer, who 5 or 6 years ago decided that he wants to become educated. He comes out of Square Town. He is a very interesting guy.
Performed here.
And he's been here. He hangs out in Columbia now the whole time. And what is so interesting is that he's come out of the Hasidic world, but staying within it. He had to leave Monty, New York. He set up a whole shul in another neighborhood, because he's got a whole bunch of chevra who basically also feel on the edge of that community. And he set up a whole community in Airmont, which is apparently somewhere near Monty. And he's gone to college. He's now going to graduate school. It's unbelievable. And I asked the Reb Lippe, I said, what is the hardest thing for you to do? He says, not to express himself. He's very out there. If you've seen him, he's like John, what's the Elton John, the glasses. He's got a pair of glasses every day of the week. Very extrovert character. But what he finds so difficult is writing essays. He just can't write. He hasn't had that training. It's a fascinating guy. But it's very fascinating. Worth maybe, you know, sort of getting him to come and speak as opposed to come and sing. If you like his music, that's all well and good. I'm not so excited about his music, but that's a separate issue. The third question, which to me is the challenge, and I wrote about this, I was picked up by Mizrahi.org this week in an email. They found one of the pieces I wrote a few years ago on this very topic. And the question I have for the very religious community that wants to keep all of the non-Jewish influences out is that there's certain things that you want in your community. How are you ever going to achieve it? How are you ever going to get what we call the frum doctor, the frum lawyer? How are you going to ever get anybody like that? There's a YouTube film made a few years ago. Ben Bruffman, who's very well known in New York, a defense lawyer, who was speaking to a group like this in Borough Park. And he stands up and says to them that, explaining a lot of the sort of cases that he deals with, and what he's really saying to them, he says, I want this to be totally theoretical. I don't want to have any of you as clients. Because if you are not going to behave and going to mess around in your finances or whatever, then unfortunately we may meet in court. And that's something he wanted to make sure they got the message loud and clear. Fascinating. So again, putting all of these kind of interesting things together, we get back to what, to me, is the Rambam's classic definition, Shvila Zahav, finding the golden mean, the golden path. The way through is to find some sort of central path. Agreed, getting too close, assimilation is a challenge. And that's a very, to me, is probably the more serious challenge of the day. Keeping further away, there's always going to be anti-Semitism. I'm not sure if we're ever going to cure it. It's worrying that it's come up against in such a vile way in the last few weeks in this country, and it's hit the headlines, so I suppose maybe that's a good thing. I hope it's a good thing. And, you know, that people have become aware of it. But the reality of it is that finding some sort of Shvila Zahav, finding this golden path in the middle somewhere, in other words, to say, look, I've got to be discerning. I can't take on everything that the non-Jewish world around me does. The haircuts are crazy. The clothing is crazy. Tattoos and everything else. You know, leave me alone already. This is way too much. On the other hand, there are certain things which, coming out of that particular world, which I need. I need the studying. I need the knowledge. I need the interaction. I need to be able to sort of, you know, if I'm part of a law firm, part of an accounting firm, part of a doctor's practice, whatever it is, I have to, you know, sort of learn how to be part of that and to succeed at that. And bottom line is Shvila Zahav and Kiddush Hashem. I think we bear those two things in mind and try our best to do this, then we can negotiate what is otherwise, I would argue, a real minefield. I hope this, again, you know, I like people to go away and think about what we're saying. Any comments, any thoughts?
What about those shekels that come from the Orient?
I shouldn't go on tape saying this, but the rabbi who brought that to the attention of the world comes from London. And and unfortunately, it was such a storm in a teacup, or whatever expression you want to use. Why I find it music. Sorry?
No.
Someone very much more to the right. The whole thing was a shtut. It was a nonsense. It was so bad that these shaitan, which were $2,000-$3,000 a piece, were being, you know, almost ritually burned by the people who were wearing them. If I was their husbands, I would have pulled my hair out, let alone pulling the other hair out. The strange thing was, I was teaching at brewery at the time. And I thought it was, you know, like you have pajama day and you have dress down day. So all the ladies from Lakewood came in, the teachers, and they were wearing hats. No shaitels. I thought it was no shaitel day. Until somebody explained to me, no, there's something more serious than that. Unforgettable. It was absolutely unforgettable. What can I say? I understand why people reject the values of non-Jewish world. There's so many difficult issues there too. You know, and one has to be discerning. But for goodness sake, we are able in so many things in life to build a way of discerning, of filtering, whatever word you want to use. And this is the challenge, essentially, of being the more modern type of Jew in the world, is to learn how to filter, to learn how to deal with it. And ideally, not only to conquer it, but to impress upon it our values. That's why Jonathan Sacks, for instance, is such a great representative of the Jewish people, because he's such a great communicator. He's good with words. And that gets across not only to the Jewish world, but also when he's in the House of Lords, he stands up for Jewish causes. Phenomenal. And that is the way to go. That is clearly in everyone at their level. Not all going to be at his level, but whatever level we can be at, that, I think, is the way to go. We try our best, and I leave you to think about that. 2 weeks' time, Bezrat Hashem, talking about Kashrut, something very simple. Not so simple. We'll come to that. Bezrat Hashem, 2 weeks' time. Not next week. 2 weeks' time, please God. Thank you, everybody. Have a good evening.